Thanks so much, Garrett. Really, really helpful. So I'm going to invite our panelists to come up with the conclusion of our conversation. So we have Joel, Sharon, and Doug Logan going to come and join us, answer some of our questions. Where's Sharon? Oh, hi, Sharon. Okay, let me quickly introduce our panelists. Joel Kurtz is a pastor at Garden Church in Baltimore. And Doug Logan is the co-director of Church in Her Places, an initiative of Acts 29, and a former pastor at Epiphany Camden. And Sharon Dickens is the women's ministry director of 20 Schemes and involved in women's discipleship and evangelism with 20 Schemes. So we're going to jump into some of the questions that you guys have submitted to us, thinking specifically here about ministering to the addict. And so, Joel, let's just start with you. Just a simple question. What resources have you found to be helpful at all just to equip you as a pastor in ministering to addicts in your own community?
Crossroads, which Mez has already mentioned, we use that as well. So I meet with a group of guys and girls on Tuesdays, and we consistently are just going through that Crossroads curriculum. It's very simple. Literally, you just read it along with the people that you're walking through. Wonderful curriculum by CCEF.
Crossroads, CCEF, you should find it online.
Check it out.
Yep. Sharon, we use the same, but any other resources that you think would be helpful?
Apart from the Bible, I would be more working with someone one-to-one. Mm-hmm. So we would genuinely be just bringing the Bible to bear in that situation. So the guys would use Crossroads and teach it, and I would be there, but one-to-one I would just be using the Bible.
Okay. Any particular resource they're using one-to-one other than Crossroads?
Specifically for women, so mm-hmm. we would work through things like disciplines of a godly woman. Sharon Etheridge, I think it's called, does Every Woman's Battle. She would talk about issues specifically that women would be dealing with. So we would look at each chapter and discuss it and how it applies to life. So lots of different resources.
Okay, Doug.
Yeah, I'm much like Shaba in that regard. I'm sorry, Sharon in that regard. I got to call her Sharon on the stage. And the one-on-one, a lot of times bringing the Bible to bear. I also, much like Ms. McConnell, Ed Welch mm-hmm. is right there in Philly, right near me. And well, he's actually right near me in Camden. Yep. And I've stolen... if I could break into his office, I would steal the notes off his desk. But I've stolen just the utilization of many of his books and a lot of stuff that Paul Tripp uses, which is not exactly for addicts, but it is really, really great, like A Quest for More. Yep. That one particular book by Paul Tripp I absolutely adore.
I'm going to do a shameless plug for a resource that you actually have in your bags there. So 20 Schemes in partnership with Nine Marks is putting out a resource called the First Steps Series, which is designed to be a one-to-one curriculum, particularly for those who are struggling perhaps from an addiction background. You got a couple of free samples of that book in your goodie bag there as well. How then can we cultivate a culture of discipleship and evangelism in our local churches, particularly when it thinks about ministering to those from an experience of addiction, brokenness in their own life? And so how does that impact the way that we do ministry as a local church?
Yeah, I think what I see now is such a marginalization between ministry to the addiction, ministry to addicts, and ministry to regular people. If we ride Mez's presupposition and his definition of addict, then that should be a regular question we ask everybody coming through our membership. Not just a dude that smells bad and he looks like he's high. But when that's a part of our regular culture of the questions we ask, not just for the new member class, but throughout the time, have you picked up some addiction since our last talk? When that becomes a regular reality, it's no longer calling them to the principal's office, but it's a regular reality. I mean, in our Reformed thought, Calvin is the famous quota of our heart's idol factories. And if we ride that, then we're always seeking to disciple, work with, pray with, fast through the idols that any one of us pick up. So I think we need to change the platform, the presuppositional philosophy going into what that looks like, and not do this great marginalization between the addicts over here and the good folk over here. And when we put, and then the second thing is, as we separate, there's sometimes that our generalist, the generalist in me, can't handle some physiological things that now has become physiological, where they was just sin, addiction. Now the person could die if they come off. And so we can't be scared to send them to find good help. But that's going to require that we find places we can send them before we plant churches. What happens is they come, and the next thing you know, we're scrambling, looking for a good place. I think we have to preload that into our church planning. It can't be a reaction to addiction going into hard places. It has to be front-loaded into our church plant proposal, places we're going to work with.
If I could just add to that, too, I think that we need to just develop a culture of honesty in churches. I think with my own experience with addicts, the issue of honesty is just the big issue. Like, can you just be honest with me? And, you know, I go into so many different churches and interact with different Christians, and I just feel like so often there's just layer after layer after layer of fluff that we've got, that we just got to keep peeling off all these different layers before we actually get a glimpse into who the person actually is, you know? So I think that's the biggest hindrance that we have to discipleship in our churches, is just we're not honest from the pulpit, we're not honest with each other. And then in addition to that, I think we've got to recognize with those who are addicts, they are slaves unwillfully. They are also willful participants. I think of Ephesians 2. We are slaves, verse 1, to our sin. Yet, verse 3, we walk by the desires of our own flesh. And that's not just the addict's problem, that's all of our problems. And so I think as we are honest with our own former slavery to sin and desiring sin, I think it can open up doors to greater honesty with addicts.
So I think in some cases we need to rethink how we do discipleship. So it's, we have this idea, this fixed picture in our heads that it's once a month for an hour as you sit down and study the Bible. But that's not how I read Titus 2. Older women teaching a younger woman how to be a godly woman. And to do that, I need to be in her life and example that. So life on life, spending time together, when the trials come, a godly woman showing them how to deal with the trials that come along, because they're going to happen. And to do that, it's messy. It means we need to get involved. So I would suggest that not only do we have to think differently about how we do discipleship, but we need to cultivate that within our congregations as a general. It should be something that's happening on an everyday basis, so that when someone gets saved, addict or not suburban housewife, then there is something to plug them into. Something that is not only going to meet their need to know the word, but to see a good example who is that go-to person when they have the questions. So I think that everybody, Miss was saying earlier that addiction is part of idolatry, and we all suffer from that. I think we all need someone who is older, mature, speaking into our life and showing us and exampling us, always bringing us back to the word. And that's not a once a month thing. And if that's what you're doing, I would suggest you need to do more.
That's good. Amen. So on that, Sharon, and stick with you here. Really what we're saying then is all Christians, faithful, mature Christians, are equipped to disciple others. And we shouldn't be segregating, you know, the hard cases to the professionals, but really cultivating a culture in the life of our church where we're, so it doesn't, it's not just about how we view the addict, but it's how we view each other in the life of the church and what we're calling everybody to in our congregations. What does that look like, even at Nidri, and in your own experience?
So at Nidri, what we have is, we started with a group of 8 women, and we focused on the 8 women and discipled and shared the DNA and really invested in these women's lives. And then Titus 2, we encouraged them to invest in someone else's life. So it took time. We weren't talking about just a once a month, but really being involved in. I find it bizarre. So, I mean, I know that most of you are like a bunch of guys, but when I was teaching my kids how to be grown-ups, I just didn't book them in on a Saturday morning for a lesson on what adults look like. And so it's not it's exactly the same when we are growing, discipling, growing up Christians, because that's what it's about. We think that if we just give them a one-an-hour session, that they'll grow up into mature adults in Christ. But we wouldn't treat our kids like that. And it's exactly the same when it comes to discipleship. So those eight women, they spent time with one or two women, nothing, even one woman really, really well. And then what happened 4, 5, 6 years in, what we have is a discipleship culture in our congregation where nearly 90% of our women have a real one-to-one accountability partner who asks the really hard questions that for the first 3 weeks you were really embarrassed to be asked. They are in each other's life and know each other well. So my accountability partner actually asks me the questions now. Is Shabba, do you think that's your fear of man that's playing? Because she knows what my issues are. She doesn't even have to ask. Like, I genuinely, most of the time, don't even have to tell her because she knows me well enough. Because that is real one anothering going on, involved in each other's lives. And we don't like that because it's hard and it's messy. But the reality is we can always do something when we really want to. So in our congregation, we have this framework so that when a new believer, whether she is an addict or a 64-year-old grandma that's on the scheme, gets saved, there is this framework and it's really easy to fit them into what is already there. Is that what you were asking?
Yes, absolutely. I want to talk about those who perhaps have come to faith but have a very real serious addiction that there's going to be potential for detox and withdrawal. Through that. How do we as churches and pastors walk with somebody through that process of detox, even withdrawal from a heavy addiction?
Well, in my experience, man, I've done my best to try to pull in their actual family members and not just me and the church family. I do that too, but try to pull them in. I'm from the hood, man. Like, I'm more ashamed in front of my mama than the church. So if I can get the addict's mama at the table who's giving up, like he might just give him a little, you know, jolt at the rehab. And so just going there and then not dropping him off like a lawnmower to get fixed and go pick him up when it's done, but being actively involved, actively involved in the process as much as you can, according to the laws and rules of the rehab center, where they don't allow you in or do allow you in, and all of that. But I just think, again, and then secondly, we've got to be ready for them, like Shabba just said, when they come home. When they come home, we want new people, places, and things in, for, and around them. And we need somebody who can be committed to that discipleship process. Now, if you're a church planner, you probably just can't walk with every addict if you're in the hood. I'm in the hood. I mean, like, it's just impossible. So we're back to the culture of discipleship, and do we have Padawans or Jedis when it comes to addicts? I'm telling you, we're all Padawans, but our Jedi training has to go across the table and not special ninjas for addicts and then regular old karate for regular people. And so we have to beef up. You know, in the Muslim culture, dudes quit school in eighth grade and they're, you know, not eating pork and reading books in Arabic, and yet at the church we scared to challenge somebody because they might get mad and leave. Let them go. We got to step up, and in that step up, as we walk with them, we go to the rehab center, we're prepared when they get home with new people, places, and things. We're looking for jobs, we're looking for opportunities for continued, and we've got somebody to walk with them and help navigate them through the storm, especially off that initial coming back home.
Great. No, that's good. And I'll just add to that, I think as they come home with new believers outside, by the way, we got Hopkins in Baltimore, so that's a huge help for us as far as rehab and detox goes. But outside of that, I think intentional living can be key, bringing somebody into your home. I think a lot of times we're afraid to bring an addict into our home because of all the stereotypes.
Right.
But in our church, that's one of the biggest helps we've seen.
I read an article about how addicts in Vietnam, after the Vietnam War, they came home and their addiction went away. And what they discovered was they were addicts in Vietnam, but not addicts in the States. There can be an environmental aspect, you know, just the habit, force of habit of your environment as to why you keep using. We've literally seen guys, thinking one dude in particular who was just strung out, moved in with a family in our church, and stopped using. And that doesn't work for everybody, but changing the environment, bringing them into a healthy home can be a huge help for new believers.
Part of that could be removing somebody from a particular community for a season, but that doesn't mean removing them from the life of the church. And so what we have at 20 Schemes at the James Ramsey House, when you talk a little bit about the vision behind that discipleship home, what it is, what it isn't, and why the church would own a house outside of its community.
So we own a house, a very pretty house, 40 minutes outside of Nidri, and it's not a rehab. It is a discipleship home where it's a family home. We just had an American couple run it for the last couple of years. It was their home. And people who are struggling in their context have a safe haven to go to, and then they come in every day to Nidri to be discipled, to be part of the work, and then go home to the safe haven at night time. It provides a really good buffer. So one of my girls lived there for about 18 months, and a lot of the stuff that you would want to challenge while she was in the schemes, when we took her out the environment, she had the headspace to think it through herself. It really gave her a safe place to just work through some of her issues with God. So for us, it's had its hard times as well as its good times. It's a good resource we have.
So something, I guess, to consider there is not, you don't have to start a rehab facility, but just having a space outside the community where your church can house people and create a family environment there away from the community that they're in could be really helpful. I'm going to talk about just the last couple of questions here about prescription medication. And sometimes medical professionals will prescribe some prescription substances to help addicts with withdrawal or to remove themselves from a particular addiction. What should our relationship be as pastors, as we're counseling and discipling those struggling with addiction, as it relates to what the doctor's prescribing them to help with that addiction?
I'm not a doctor, so I can't speak with authority on that. I've got friends who are doctors, and I've had a lot of conversations with them, and I would say that they're not unified on all of those approaches. I would just simply say this. I want to work with doctors as much as possible, and it may be a medical condition, but it's always going to be a sin condition, right? And so no matter what they're taking, we can't trust the pill, is my point. We can't trust the medication. We've got to, you know, if that helps them, frees them up from some of those pressures that they're facing so that we can get to the deeper stuff, then wonderful.
Yeah. Doug, you got anything?
I would just echo that. I'm not a doctor. I'm a pastor, and there's no unification clearly on there. This is what I would push if it were my son and members of my church. I would tell them to make their doctor fully aware of their addiction, and if there's any means by which he can work something with and work something out. If he's not aware, he's just going to do standard ops of writing what you need. But often, because of a shame culture, we don't tell them. So I emphasize to cats from my church, like, yo, make sure you tell the doctor your struggles and your challenges. Let the gospel deal with the shame of that. You good, you free, you new creature. Go ahead and tell him. And then as he tells him, man, the doctor now can maybe modify and do more to put the onus on that. Yeah. And then even after that, I tell him, when you get home, tell me what he gave you, because we're still walking in accountability to that particular thing as well. So it's, I hope everybody's hearing, this is messy, hard work. This ain't happening with no watch no videos and go to CCEF and come home. I think about Mez McConnell, one of the beastiest urban cats, man. Like, I stayed at Mez's crib. Like, there's cats all over the house that he done took off the street. I was like, who's that? Is that your cousin? Nah, he from the street. What? They're integrated into the reality of his life and into the reality of the church. You know, Pastor Mez talked one time, we were together, and he says, we got to write a book called Missional Living Sucks. Because in reality, this is your whole life, your whole family, your everything thrown into this. So if you come to the table, church planner, with dreams of just getting 20,000, a webpage, and a TV show, this ain't the faith for that. You want to plant in a hard place, you better get different kind of locks and wings and be prayed up if you got daughters and you're bringing men into your home. So it's hard. It's rough.
Everybody always wants to know, what's the proven method? What works? There is no silver bullet.
Yep.
It's just messy.
Yep. Absolutely. You know, we want to point people to hope and integrate them into life, a local church, and walk with them in the hard places through the hard times. And so appreciate you guys for your insights. And I got a lot of respect for our sign interpreter for interpreting you guys and all the things that we've done this morning for your hardest assignment yet. I'm going to invite a friend of ours, Jim Silvestro, to come and Jim Stitzinger, to come and close us out. And I really appreciate your time and appreciate everybody participating this morning.
Well, good to be with you all, and what an incredible morning. Let's thank these guys for all they have done and be a part of this time. You know, it was C.T. Studd who said, some want to live in the sound of chapel bells. I want to run a rescue shop, what? Within a yard of hell. And that's where we live, and that's where we find people battling with addiction. That's where we find people who are blindly, hopelessly running towards a Christless eternity. That whole lesson was punctuated even Saturday morning when I got the notice that a friend of mine had taken his own life after a horrific battle with addiction. This is not, as I think you said, this is not a clean thing. This is not a sterile thing. It does get blood on your jersey just getting in this arena. Years ago, there was a lifeguard gathering of about 100-plus lifeguards that were together, celebrating, talking, sharing stories, networking, all kinds of things going on in their conversations. And no one noticed a young man gasping for breath in the pool only feet away. A young man named Jerome Moody drowned at a lifeguard gathering. I heard that story, and it always comes to mind when I hear that and I get in rooms like this and in rooms like what's going to happen at the Yum Center, is that it is possible to drown at a lifeguard gathering. It's also possibly battling with all these things we've been talking about and be in this room. And if that's you, there's hope and there's help, and I hope you've heard that. But it also takes you putting your hand on the person next to you and saying, I need help, and I need it now, and we will help you. I get to serve with Southern Seminary. We've got a table in the back there. If you're considering a call to ministry, you need training, we want to be able to provide that for you, whether it's you moving to Louisville and we get to put you in a classroom with the world's best theologians, or it's you jumping online, taking classes online, living around the world, wherever God has you, we want to be part of that with you. Let me pray for you. And let's head out of here. And as I said, with Southern, you can stop by the table on the way out the door. We'd love to give you everything we can to help train you, equip you for the ministry. Father, thank you for what you've done here. Thank you for those who have spoken, for those who have answered questions, for those who have asked questions. Thank you for the transformation that's true, even in this room, that we look each other in the eye and have no idea the stories that it's taken for you to rescue us from a Christless eternity. But you've done it, Lord. And as we gather later on today with the rest of those who are here for T4G, as we sing songs of praise to you, Lord, it's the closest thing to heaven we get to know on this earth. And while we do it now, we look forward to the day when we will see you face to face. But until that day, give us courage, give us boldness, give us momentum towards unbelievers. Help us to find those who don't want to know you and confront them with the gospel and see your spirit break their hearts and bring them to you so we can celebrate as brothers and sisters in Christ. So thank you for this morning, the incredible story and start that we have seen to this conference, and we look forward to all you'll do through 20 schemes, the partnerships here, and the work that's ahead. In your name, amen.